Hi, welcome to another podcast by the Oxford Society for International Development. My name is Esther Coomber and I'm the Europe Events Officer. I'm in my second year studying history at Magdalen College. I'm very excited to be bringing you one of the first podcasts of the term. I'm delighted to be joined today by Zufi Deo, the co-founder of BizGees. BizGees supports refugee entrepreneurs in new and innovative ways. BizGees helps refugees to become economically engaged and generate wealth for themselves, as well as jobs for those around them. Zufi has spoken at global events such as the Sharing Economy Global Summit in London in 2021 and at FinTech Week in London in 2019. In this podcast, we will be exploring the business model of BizGees and how this fosters sustainable development. Zufi, thank you so much for joining me today and welcome to the podcast. Why did you decide to set up BizGees and what motivated you to do this?
Sure. BizGees is an offshoot of the Swartz Valley Guild. Basically, a friend of mine I went to school with, he is from Swartz Valley. And I bumped into him after about 20 years. Hadn't seen each other. And I was quite surprised that he wasn't living there. And yes, I had heard about the problems with the handy, etc. But from what I'd known about him growing up, and we did a primary school together, secondary school together, etc. And from what I remember about him was that every spare minute of his time, he would go back home to the Swartz Valley. And because we were boarding together at the time, so every holiday, every weekend he could spare, he would go back there. So I was really surprised that for the last 10 years or 15 years now, he had been living away from there. So, and for me, knowing what I had known about him growing up, I mean, that would have been, emotionally, that'd been really tough for him to do, to spend that time away from there. So we hooked up, we started talking, and I could still feel that he had still had that passion for that region there and the people he'd grown up with, etc. there. And we decided to do something for that region in a way that supported his emotional needs as well. So his needs for his identity needs, his needs to support the people who his family have grown up with, etc. So those human needs that he had, we felt that we should do something about it, but in a positive and constructive way, so in a forward-looking way. There's a lot of political instability there. There's a lot of security issues going on there. Then there's the infrastructure issue, etc. So we didn't want to delve into politics. We didn't want to delve into crowding out what the government was trying to do there, what the local NGOs were trying to do there. So we decided to organise the guild in a way which helped the locals identify again with their heritage, but in a way that they could earn a living as well. So that's how the focus on jobs and wealth came up, was that, I mean, there was this deep need they had locally was on jobs. Okay, the Taliban have been pushed out. We are now coming back to the region. What do we do here now? Do we do what we were doing before? Do we do something else? So then they had challenges of industrialization. Do we give up the old ways? Artisanship has been there for centuries, and they have a very strong tradition of it. So Kashmir, Pashminas, Angora, all these kind of top-end woolen products still come from there, and they've been doing it since the days of Silk Road. So from that point of view, the issues were that we could either get wholesale industrialization, which is that these people then have to go to a factory to work and all that kind of stuff, and yes, it'll create jobs, it'll create wealth, etc., but the identity issues wouldn't be covered by that. So we're not dealing with the downsides of industrialization or anything like that at this stage. We're just looking at what's the meaning for a local person. So if someone is in the way that artisan tradition works there, is it gets passed on the generations. And so if there's a break in that generation, so one generation doesn't pass on to the other, what happens with the following generation? Would they, if they want to take it up, would they still be able to take it up? So these were the kind of issues that we were dealing with, and that's how we came up with the concept of the guild, was because that would collate the expertise of the region. So say someone, we skipped a generation, and someone wanted to come back into it, was a new arrival wanted to enter that heritage, it made it easier for them. But it'd be, but that skill loss that would normally happen wouldn't happen. So so that's how we came up with the idea of the Swahili Guild. And I took that to the UNICEF FinTech Jam for Good. I mean, I'm very big on technology. 20 years ago, I was working on an artificial intelligence solution where we would use advertising and behavior profiling. And that, even today, is quite sophisticated. So because that's that was my background too, I thought we could mesh it up together and see what is that we could come up with. And while we were at the UNICEF FinTech Jam for Good, within the first day of being there, we quickly realized we couldn't use technology in any specific way there, simply because the region is, it's quite high up in the mountains. And it's very difficult to use everyday technology there. So we would have to build entire infrastructure to support it. And but that wasn't the business. Our business isn't getting involved with infrastructure development. It's not we're not in the business of political security with these kinds of things. Our simple mission was to focus on jobs and wealth in a way that met the human needs of the local people. So we then pivoted away from Swahili Guild and came up with BizGs. And at that time, BizGs' focus was on peer-to-peer microloans for refugees inside UN camps. So the idea was, let's say people like yourself have a passion for these issues, you could support a refugee micro-business inside a UN camp using technology. And you would then lend them money, they would receive the money, they would scale up the business, and that focus on jobs and wealth was still there. And we won the UNICEF FinTech Jam for Good on that project, and then we took it to market. But over the years, it has evolved into what it is today. And what's changed is, yes, the geography has changed, the focus has changed. But what is at the very heart of it, what we have innovated is a formula for human-centered design, which is that you focus on human beings, end users, and you get a very deep understanding of who they are, what they're about, what their needs are, and then you use technology to enable it, which means that over time you configure technology to amplify what they do, to basically make their lives easier using technology. So we're not looking to replace people using technology, which is the usual conversation with technology is it destroys jobs, etc. From our perspective, our school of thought is it creates jobs rather than destroys it. An example for that is, say, in Japan, where they're using robots to help disabled people to earn a living. So you could have disabled people on a bed in a home, but in a restaurant, they could have a robot who's serving people, but he would be taking the orders from the people using the robot. So he can then, so he's a human voice, he's a human eye there, but the robot is doing the donkey work in terms of the physical work of collecting the order, taking it to the kitchen, bringing the food out and serving the people. So that's how we see technology, is it's an enabler to help us achieve more than we otherwise could. And so that's how BizGs came up. And we've had reasonable amounts of success. So we won the UNICEF FinTech Jam for Good. We were one of the first social enterprises to be accepted onto the F10 FinTech program in Zurich. And it was the first time they were running the program, and they thought having such an enterprise would be quite innovative. So we were there. And if you look at all the programs that we've applied to, they're all top of programs, either have national recognition or international recognition. So we've been really fortunate in that sense. It's nice to see that our approach is now starting to enter the mainstream, which is a focus on the human beings.
Thank you. That was very interesting and very comprehensive. So I understand that you have a background in business strategy and business mentoring. And how does this inform your work at BizGs? You mentioned the technology.
I think before I go into business strategy and business mentoring, I think just to give you some background, during my MBA, there was a project coming out of Harvard University. One of the professors there, I call him Vijay for short, it was fixed on a $300 house. So the idea was that we know we can't produce a house of $300, but if we tried, even if the price dropped down to $3,000, that would still be better than $30,000 or $300,000. So what is it that we can do using our acumen, our intellectual acumen, etc., to focus on that very problem. And I think that influenced a lot of what I do and how I do it. So yes, I did get published in business strategy. My MBA, 30% of my MBA was focused very much on business strategy and applying it for a business. So ever since then, I've been working with other SMEs and supporting entrepreneurs. And for 10 years, till last year, I supported, alongside 10 other professional service providers, we supported 2,000 entrepreneurs in London, basically. Part of that was we also supported King's, King's College London. We all organized business mentoring for them. So in those days, they used to have, once a year, they used to have business plan competitions. So we supported their postgraduate students and staff on that. So in the 6 years, we did that once a year with them. Oxford University Entrepreneurship Society, we worked with them closely as well in the early days. So from our point of view is that we were trying to promote entrepreneurship in an open and inclusive way. So that meant, if it meant that working with a third party, that was great. If it meant us working by ourselves, that was fine as well. So we, along the way, we ended up working with the British government. So there was a Korean presidential visit to the UK, South Korea, by the way. And they wanted business mentors. In those days, business mentoring wasn't widely available in the UK. So we were one of the first groups organising it. And so we organised 10 business mentors for them. We met at Google Campus, spent the entire day supporting Korean businesses as business mentors. And it was a positive, from our point of view, is that the British government would want us to turn up. So it gave us a degree of legitimacy. And so from that point of view, it's taking the open, inclusive approach of mentoring and knowledge sharing over the years has been really supportive for society as well as for us. In those days, we were all working as individuals. So when I set up BizG's, I wanted to use all those learnings inside BizG's. So the $300 house concept was that why don't we design businesses where instead of going for profit maximization, you can go for optimization. So how much money is enough? The common adage is that if you look at, say, people like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, they spend their lives making money. At the end of their lives, they decide to give it all away. So instead of taking that route, which is that you spend your entire life working and making money, and then at the end of it, you don't know what to do with it and give it away, why don't we just fuse the two together? So you make money in a way which supports wider publics, wider societies along that way. So this way, you lead a more balanced life. You get to make some money, you have a different living standard. But beyond that, if you look at the people who have made lots of money, most of the time it gets to a point where money loses its meaning to them. So they ended up giving it away. So what is that level that you target which is enough? You've got a house, you've got a car, your family's safe and secure. Beyond that, what is it that you're looking for in life? Okay, your friends are happy, your relatives are happy, your broader communities is fine as well. So then what? Then the planet and all these issues do matter to us as human beings. So why don't we factor that into the business from day one? And so as the business scales, you can then see that impact coming through. So if you look at our impact in BizG's, there's a footprint of 4 different continents. We focus on a 5-fold impact, and we're looking just to scale that up now. So that means it is very much the case that it's not just about the refugees, it's also about the local community. We don't want to be seen as an organization who takes from one part of the world and gives it to another. It's not a redistribution organization, basically. So we get it that locals in London have these issues. We get it locals in Uganda have these issues. So how can we come up with a solution that meets all their needs? So that's where the business mentoring comes into it. So if you look at, say, how we organise a volunteering programme in BizG, that's very much about supporting local talent. So along the way, we came across artists who need to build up their brands and earn a decent living. So we support them. How do we support them? We work with volunteers, bring them up, who then can add to them. So through sales and marketing training, all these kind of things. And so the student ambassadorship programme I mentioned, I'd be very much focused on marketing and sales, but not your hard selling. It's very much about these different concepts of sales. This is what kind of sales you use, in what context. This is how you build that expertise. And that's something that stays with you when you go for a job interview, for instance. You have to sell yourself. When you go for your promotion, you have to sell yourself. All these things that mean come into it. How do you organize that and how do you scale it up? So if we were to just use a standard business model where we have employees, like 8-10 employees, we scale up the product and service, that externality, I mean, that positive impact we create wouldn't be scalable. And that's the issue, is how do we structure a business in a way which has a maximum impact as we scale up? So so that's been the philosophy, that's been the core of the business strategy. And that also has been core at why we are so people-centric and why we are so big on our volunteering program. And hence, we work with lots of careers. You know, we're starting with King soon. The University of East London is joining us as well. So there's some American universities joining in as well. So from that point of view, this is how we scale it up. We come up with a formula, we try it, we test it, and then we design it in a way that we can then magnify it.
Could you possibly tell me more about how your business model directly impacts refugees and those in post-conflict communities?
Sure. When we first set up BizGs, we knew that we were going to have a footprint on different continents. But we also knew was that it may dilute what we want to do with the refugee communities, the post-conflict communities. So the way we design BizGs, we started off with the refugee communities and post-conflict communities, and now we've gone for depth within these communities. And so if you look at BizGs as a tree, our roots are these post-conflict communities. So without them, we wouldn't exist. And that's become part of the BizGs DNA, is that as we scale, those post-conflict communities stay as part of what we do. And so if you look at everything that we do is arts for refugees, or BizGs is business for refugees, shortened into BizGs. So we've been ingrained into our DNA that the refugees are part of what we do here. And then everything else comes later on. So as we scale up, that will mean, so as our revenue scale up, this post-conflict communities benefit proportionally. So we've got a ratio going in Uganda, for instance, every sale we make on our e-shop, they get a percentage. Every upcoming designer we work with creates jobs in Mother's Wealth Valley. And as we scale up our presence on different continents, the same thing would happen again and again and again. So for instance, we want to work with in Latin America. We want to work in Nigeria, for instance. We want to have a look at Malaysia, Rwandas, etc. So I'd say, if you look at it, the entire rest of the world will be represented. We don't want to be seen as one country, one region, specific business. So from that point of view, it is a global business for global people, globally organised. So that's how we view ourselves.
On your website, you mentioned the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. Why is sustainable development important to you and BizGs?
Sure. The sustainable development comes into how we realise our mission. So, excuse me, from our point of view, is that if we look at, say, how you go about achieving your aim, that matters too much. That matters as much to us as anything else. So it's not you doing the right thing, you're also doing the right thing in the right way. So that's the right way. So that's where the sustainable development goals come in. Because when we first started off, we were very much, we knew that we wanted to do things the right way, but we weren't quite sure what that meant, or how do we articulate to third parties in a way that they would accept. So we started off with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and we gradually refined that again and again and again. So on the one side, we have our human needs. So we use our framework for 7 human needs. Then we go for the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which human needs fits into one development goal, and that generates the activity. So it was, but there are still gaps within the UN Development Goals because they're quite broad. So for instance, if you look at, say, what we did in the Swat Valley, is the focus areas on eco-ethical supply chains, slave labour, child labour, these kind of issues there is quite big, pollution, water resources, etc. But there's no industry standard within the development goals that we can then use, because one of the issues they have, the artisans have, is a lot of the women work from home. And if they work from home, you can't plug them into a supply chain because you can't certify the health and safety conditions that they're working in. So we've had to go outside the system to and go to a Nest Foundation, in the US. And they co-created these compliances with industry. So we simply use their standards for that purpose. So that then, so you have the human needs, you have the development goals, then you have those kind of compliances, then you have the artisans at the end. And it's a very long cycle there, because a lot of the issues that we're dealing with have never been dealt with before, or they've never been formalized, or there's no international standard to it. So we're quite big on articulating ourselves, at least, in a way which puts us in front of the international community so they can understand us. So one of the issues that we've had is that it doesn't matter how sophisticated we are or what we do, is if we can't, if people don't see it that way, they won't get it. And it's not that they mean ill, or you know, they don't want to get it. It says you have to communicate your concepts in a way that they can understand. And that's where the communication aspect comes in. So if you remember during the internship, one of the core focuses was on the communications aspect, is how do you articulate a concept to a general person in a way that they can absorb, process, build awareness, recall, etc. And I think that's been quite an important challenge for us at BSG, is what we're doing internally is very sophisticated. But when you articulate it to a third person, we have to do it in a way that that person understands. And using these third-party standards helps us achieve that.
What are some of the challenges that you face, and how did COVID-19 affect your business?
In terms of challenges, I mean, I just mentioned the communications one. Then it's the e-support ecosystem. Because we're a social enterprise, so we're a hybrid business. So we have the economic side, and we have the social side integrated into one business formally. And there's not a lot of support out there for organizations like us. So if you're a standard business, even then it's quite tough. So if you were to get accelerator programs and investors, etc., it's a struggle trying to access funding, for instance. Whereas with us, it's twice as hard, because being on the one side, the investors get the revenue side, but they won't get the social side, or they see us as a charity, but not as the economic side of it, the economic value we generate. So in the early days, there was a lot of interest, but the interest was more sentiment-based rather than substance-based. So for the first year or so, we were applying to VCs, social VCs, etc. But all the VCs that we applied to, even if they were social VCs, had the same criteria. It is an economic investment on an economic basis. You know what you generate, social value. I mean, we're sensitive to that, but we don't really care about it. And to us, I mean, that's not what we do. That moves us away from who we are, what we do. So we've taken a step back. I mean, I've been funding the business ever since, till we get to a stage where that market is a bit more mature. So the ecosystem is there, and so when we talk about social value and economic value, people get it. It doesn't have to be perfect, it's having custom design, but the point is to get that there's social value there. And I think, when I sell the business to an investor, or sell it conceptually to an investor to get investment, the idea is that I'm not selling it to the wrong person. So that then avoids problems later on, because for instance, one of the issues we've had is angel investors. We had a lot of interest there, but 90% of them wanted to do it for tax breaks. They don't care about vision, the mission, anything like that. Tax breaks in, we'll invest. And that, to me, is completely the wrong kind of money that you can access for a business, because what it says is if tax breaks disappear tomorrow, your money disappears tomorrow. You have no interest. It's not smart money, is what I'm trying to say. So within the smart money, we're trying to focus on the smart money who gets the mission, the vision, these kinds of things there. And that is starting to happen gradually. So hopefully within the next year, 2 years, we'll be planning to programs where they get the impact is, they want us to focus on the impact first and then the rest second, which is what we do. So gradually the market is maturing. Well, I'm saying maturing, but it is emerging as a marketplace where we can access the support that we need.
Building on from that, how do you ensure and how will you ensure that your business remains sustainable?
I think you've touched on quite an important point is one of the dilemmas that we have in the business as we scale. I mean, what tends to happen is a lot of the founders feel that the business sold their soul. So the scaling up, I was talking to one of the guys who set up Virgin Money. And in the early days, it was great. The mission was there, the vision was there, the empathy was there, everything was there. But then once they sold it and they said once the MBAs got involved and scaled up the business, it just changed the business. It was no longer about people, systems, all that kind of stuff. And so, yes, so that's quite an important dilemma for us to focus on. And the approach that we are taking is that the way we structure the business is different. So this is where the business structure comes in. So from a corporate point of view, the way we structure the business is that we structure it in a way that it is scalable. We do use technology in a big way to achieve that scale. So, but we do it in a way that retains the vision, the mission, the values. So if you look at, say, what we do with Oxford Careers, we only organize internships 3 times a year. We can do it more often, but we limit it to 3 times a year. Within that, there's only X amount of interns we can take on. So we did 25 last year. We're looking to do roughly the same this year, but we're not looking to go for 50 or 70 or 100 because we know what I just mentioned. I mean, those kind of issues come into it. And this is a standard dilemma between value and volume. Is that if you go for volume, you lose the value. Your values get diluted because it's no longer, it becomes very quantitative rather than qualitative experiences. So the kind of experiences I had with you where I was personally talking to you during the internships, that sort of dies away because I can't do that for 100 people simultaneously. So those are the kind of issues that we have to deal with. And so we were structuring it in a way where we retain that personal relationship, but in a way that allows us to achieve growth. And so far, we feel that is achievable using technology. So that's where the tech comes in and it allows us to scale. I mean, if you look at, say, the retweets on Twitter, you can have 1,000 retweets and it won't be a big deal for us. I mean, I won't get a headache if something goes wrong there. I just need to delete one or something like that, edit or something like that. So from that point of view, technology allows us to do that, but you have to configure technology for that purpose to achieve it. So that's how we're looking to retain our values.
You've told us a bit about Arts for Refugees. Would you mind explaining more about this and how it impacts people in London?
Sure. I mean, the issue we've had with BizGs is that we're doing a lot of work there. So when I say a lot of work, I mean, we're in different parts of the world and we are, on one side, we've got a volunteer program, we're supporting students, on one side, we're supporting the artists, on one side, we're supporting personal communities, and each of them are stakeholders in their own right. And they all come under the umbrella of BizGs. The issue is that when we try to articulate it to our customers, they get confused with everything that's going on. They say, okay, is this about the Swap Valley? Is this about Uganda? Is this about the students? Is this about the artists? Is this about the Americans? Is this about the British? So there are 10,001 questions they have there. So we decided to have a brand where we can focus very specifically on just a specific set of issues. So the Arts for Refugees brand now is focused on undiscovered artists, at this stage London, but eventually the UK, the US and the EU, and we help them build up their brands and earn a decent living. Now, along the way, the money we help them generate, they share with the refugee communities that we support. So, and it's that simple. So if you look at, say, what BizGs does, what we're doing to Arts for Refugees, it's much more narrowly focused. And that allows us to organise our communications, that allows us to work to organise the RT refugees, for instance. So over the last 100 years, here are artists. from a refugee background, and it's just simply putting that in the public domain helps the public relate to the refugee experience. So again, the refugee side of it is embedded into that brand. The profits go to supporting refugee communities, and all the while it supports local talent. So now we're shooting four or five different things using one brand, but the way we articulate it is very simple, very straightforward. It's about local artists, they want to earn a decent living, local talent benefits, and do ecological friendly. So I can't do that under those GPs. So that's why we set up Arts for Refugees, and that's why we focus on building it as a brand. So it's something that people can touch and feel. So it is about the arts, it's about refugees, and it's an interaction between the two. And again, it's focusing on the arts for supporting refugees helps take the politics out of it altogether. Because one of the biggest issues that they have is anything to do with refugees becomes very political very quickly, because of crossing borders, I mean, you have different political factions, you have different perspectives, etc. So we don't want to get bogged down in all of that. What we want to do is hand it to the public. You know what? This is the biggest mass migration in human history, at least since the Second World War. It's going on today. These issues are real. Let's do something about them. And here's a solution. The solution is that you want to support your local talent. Here's the local talent. That talent, the more successful that talent is with us, the more these refugees are better off. And as a customer, you only make one purchase to generate all this impact. So from a customer point of view, it's very simple, very straightforward. I just buy a bag, buy a t-shirt, buy a top. The local artist benefits, great. Probably scale to supporting refugees even better. And it's an eco-ethical friendly, which meets our criteria. So we've custom designed around the customer by spending a lot of time with the customers and all of this. So as time's going on, that's our focus in terms of A, why we have arts refugees, and B, how that helps us achieve more than what we could do through refugees.
Do you plan to expand your work, and how do you think that your business model and initiatives could be applied to different groups of people or in different locations?
Yeah, that's just geographically. So on the one side, we have a geographical expansion, so we go to different communities. So our service, our support providers in Uganda also have a presence in Kenya and Rwanda, I think. And the idea is that wherever they are, we can be as well. So that's not an issue. So we can just scale it up there, then come to Nigeria and all these other places. So geographically, yes, I mean, that's a natural evolution. The more money we make, the more communities we can support. But beyond that is that this essentially is still a fintech. It is a social impact fintech. So because we started off using peer-to-peer, so everything that we discuss with the Arts Refugee brand, that retains a peer-to-peer engagement. The ones that you have the customer, you have the artists, that they're talking to each other, learning about each other. Then you have the refugees. They're part of that equation there, so they're learning about the refugees. Every time they'll be visiting them, spending time with them, etc. So that's the entire as a peer-to-peer is still retained. Then comes the the other side of the business, which is more the business side of things, which is we're talking to a company later on today about organizing career profiles for the refugees, for instance. So financial exclusion is a very big deal among refugee communities. So our know-how, their technology can potentially work together. So if that's possible, we will be working together. And then, so that will then support a lot more quantity of refugees. Another side is we're looking to use cryptocurrencies, crypto mining, crypto trading, etc., to generate revenue, which then supports the refugees. So all of those are work in progress, but we're starting off with the people side of things, because we want to retain the humanity and the people side within this business. So everything now is going to be designed around it. Another side of the business can potentially be supporting governments. So governments have funding to support, I don't know, post-conflict communities in some kind of way. We can then partner with local organisations to make it more efficient or bring their know-how to the table, these kind of things. So that's the potential revenue stream for us, but it also supports the refugee communities at the same time. So all these tiers are there, so there are about two or three more tiers. But we're starting off with the people side of it, then we're going for deeper impact.
Thank you so much for your time. It has been so interesting to hear about BizJews and how your work promotes sustainable development.